Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me in the studio, I have Victoria Harwood Butler-Schloss, an Anglo-Armenian filmmaker and writer from Cyprus, who is presently in Los Angeles. Welcome, Victoria.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's really good that we eventually managed to connect our schedules, yeah. And because we've been trying for a while.
Yeah.
And you've had quite a creative, colorful career, but I will start with what you are presently working on, and we'll work ourselves back. You're presently trying to finish off your last novel called Love in Aleppo. Tell us about it.
Correct. Well, Love in Aleppo is the second story in the trilogy that I have written. Actually, all three parts are written, but you know, what you say written, but then you have to go back and edit. I think I'm on edit at 10 or 11 at the moment, trying to shape it. And it follows the story after the first book, The Seamstress of Urfa, finishes. So the first book followed my great-grandmother, Khatun, and began in 1895 in the Ottoman Empire, in the last days of the Ottoman Empire. And it goes all the way up until 1922, when they were finally forced to leave their homes. And they went to Aleppo as refugees. So the second book opens up mostly with them re-establishing their lives. It's all about rebirth and, it's not really their home, but it's like finding a place that you can call home, which is a big question for the Armenians at the time. And people are going off to Argentina, people are splitting up, the whole world is being reshaped, and they find love. And then the book ends, the first half is mostly in Aleppo, and then it goes to Cyprus. So the second half is in Cyprus. So I'm currently walking around Uzunian Street. And I sort of delve into my little trips around Nicosia at the moment while I finalize the book. And that's the hard thing, because I've got a chapter which could be a very good opening chapter for the third book, but could also act very well as a final chapter in the second book. So I'm playing with it, but I'm really very close to the end.
And when can we expect to hear about its launch?
Do you know, it's like you finish writing, or one finishes writing, and then comes the worst part of it all, which is sending it out and getting it picked up and, actually published. So, you know, let's say February. No.
Okay. Let's say maybe in the first half of 2025.
Probably not, because it takes them a long time, and then whoever takes the book is going to want to edit again. So I would say more like the end of 2025. Let's see if we can put it in people's Christmas stockings next Christmas.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's a good aim.
You've brought up two subjects that are really close to my heart with mm-hmm. what you've spoken about now. And the one is home.
Yes.
And the other one is love.
Yes.
And it's not just to the Armenians what is home. I think if we all sit down and think of what home is.
Yeah.
Firstly, it has a different meaning for us all. And in most cases, it's not necessarily a country. But yeah. I want to hear from you as an Armenian that was brought up in the UK and then came to Cyprus and married and went to Los Angeles. So you now have three homes. Tell me to you, Victoria, what is home?
Oh, God. It is difficult, because I address this in my books. It's something that comes up constantly. And in fact, one of the characters says home, I don't want to use the cliches, home is where the heart is. Home is your family. And sometimes you are uprooted from your physical home. or your house. I think I even say walls are just, you know, walls and plaster. So
exactly, they're bricks. They're just bricks.
Yes, you can leave the physical home, but I don't know where really is home. I've spent my whole life trying to figure out where my home is. And actually, everyone seems to think that I am the home, because my kids come back, you know, they're at college and working now, and they say, "Oh, I'm so glad to be home." And I'm like, "Yeah, you're with me. I'm your home now." But I mean, all my life, I suffered a sort of homesickness. And I think maybe it's in the Armenian DNA. I don't know. But, you know, always I've wondered, felt a sort of great loneliness and homesickness, but I've never been able to quite put my finger on where that home is, because it's more for a feeling, a place of peace where you feel at home, where you feel relaxed, where you feel like, ah, this is where I belong. And I don't know really where I belong except within myself. I don't know if that even answers the question.
Well, you've actually expressed a lot of what I feel, because I, like you, I was a Greek Cypriot, the Cypriot diaspora, born and brought up in South Africa. I then moved to Greece because I married a Greek. And while I was there, we used to spend 5 months, for by a period of 6 years, 5 months of every year in Chicago. And then I divorced the Greek and I came to live in Cyprus. So to me, what home is very complicated.
It is.
And I ultimately, there was a really big discussion. There's a lovely young Turkish Cypriot poetess, Navia Akdeniz,
yes,
who discusses home. And in having a discussion with her, I realized that my home is where there are olive trees. And that was the reason why I actually had an olive branch.
Oh, look at you.
On
That's
my
beautiful.
Arm.
Yeah.
On my arm, because to me, when I have olive trees around me, I'm home. I mean, it's weird because what I said to you. It's often a feeling.
Yes.
But I do understand when you speak of the sense of loneliness, even though there might be in the bricks. Or you might,
yes,
have your favorite books or paintings around. There's a longing for somewhere that you don't know.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Funnily enough, I have an olive tree named after me in Cyprus.
You do?
I do, yes, because a friend of mine, Jack Bash, he used to relocate olive trees, ancient olive trees that were in danger of being cut down for roads or developments in the north. And he would get all of these big excavators and stuff and move them around to parks and safe areas. And he wrote to me one day and said, "There's a tree, you know, it's just outside, it's beyond Gunyeli, I can't remember where it is, but there's a little park and there's a V-shaped olive tree and it's called Vicky," after me.
Well, my friend has just built a new home outside Lefkosha in the north.
Yeah.
And opposite her house are replanted old olive trees. And when I go to that house and I see these trees, it's almost like a group of people protecting her home.
Nice.
Because I find such solace in olive trees, and I don't know why, because olive trees were not part of the South African landscape.
It's funny, I have that way, I feel that way about Cyprus trees. I feel like they're almost like a finger pointing to heaven. So Cyprus trees, you know, populate my book, just sort of standing almost like silent sentries to the story.
Well, I think the reason I love the olive trees, it's a combination of resilience and magnificence.
Yes, yes. And who doesn't love olive oil? I put olive oil on everything. If I don't have a tub of olive oil in the house, people are like, "What happened?"
Well, I'm as I said, I'm on my way back to South Africa to spend time with my family. And I asked them what gifts they wanted. I said, you want some sujuk or do you want some dragana? And my sister says, no, I have, and I don't really eat it anymore. But last time you came, you brought us lovely Cypriot olive oil. So we would all, so I'm taking small bottles of olive oil with me because I mean, but me too, if there's no olive oil in the house, I panic.
Yeah, it's a comforting, it's a comforting taste and
And it's a fixture, it's a comforting fixture to know that you've got your olive oil. I don't know what it is, but the olive has suddenly become very, very important to me. And as I said, the culmination was me putting a tattoo on my with the olives.
Yeah.
An olive branch. But let's go to the second subject.
Yes.
And it's love.
Right.
And I had said to you before that I've had a lot of love from within my family, from friends, from almost people I didn't know. Been very unlucky in relationships. But you appear to have been both fortunate and unfortunate.
Yes.
So tell me what love means to you in your life.
Oh, gosh.
And you can even talk about the love of your life if you feel you
yes,
want to.
Yes, yes, yes. We should... We should mention William. He died. He died just before my book was published, actually. I mean, I can't imagine reliving that time because it was so complicated. I remember my book was supposed to be published in the April, and my husband died in March. And I remember in January having to contact the publishers and say,
hold off.
Yeah.
Hold off with publishing.
Yeah, because I think we might be able to do it in June. And thinking about that now, having to make that decision to except that the person that you love is not going to be there in February, March, April, but they won't be there in June, but you see, I'm getting into a flummox even talking about it. So,
yeah. That's why I said to you, Victoria, if this is too painful, I don't have a problem.
It's been 5 years now, and I'm happy to talk about William. He really was the love of my life and a great support. And I do know now that not everyone does find that. And I was very, very fortunate, and that he loved me from the beginning to the end. In fact, we'd only been together for about 6 months, and we were in Dublin. And he said to me, we were just sitting down having a pizza. We were with a bunch of friends. We left them in the pub and we went out to have something to eat. And he said, you know, I just want to make sure that you are always there all the way through my life. So I said, wait, is that like a proposal?
Is that an attempt at a proposal?
Yeah, and he said, well, I suppose so. And I said, yes, I accept. And then we turned to the people on the next table, a young couple, who said, we're getting married. And they gave us the only thing they had as a gift, which was one Marlborough in a packet. They said, go and share a cigarette, to celebrate. I actually feel that I fulfilled that because he said that he wanted to be with me until his last breath, and he was. And people ask what that was like, and it is simultaneously the most beautiful thing you will ever experience and the most horrendous at the same time. But to be there when somebody that you love leaves this world, and to hold them and to see their last breath, It is such a feeling of pure love and horror. I mean, I can't describe it. I don't think I would even be able to write about it, the sort of knife edge between the two that you are on, that I was on. And sometimes I get that feeling now that he's gone. I mean, it was like a sense of panic. I would walk into the room. Sometimes I would wake up from sleep and literally jump awake and go, he's gone, because it didn't compute. I couldn't really understand he's gone. It still doesn't compute to me. I still feel like he's going to walk in the door.
I'm sure you can feel him around anyway, can't you?
I do. Especially we have had a very big connection with music. And he speaks to me with music all the time. I mean, I'm not being Californian here, but, you know, literally I will be thinking something and a song will come on, one of our songs, and it will have his sense of humor in it. I remember about a year after he died, I was driving along and I just saw just some random man walking down the road. And I thought, gosh, you know, someone somewhere loves that man. And one day, where will I ever feel anything about anyone again? And I sort of thought, what do you say, William? And I turned on the radio and this song came on. And I kind of recognized it at first and I wasn't quite sure. And then the lyrics came up and it was like, because you're free to do what you want to do. And I was like, fuck you, pardon my language.
That's okay, you speak my language.
I was like, what, now you've gone for a year, I can go and do whatever I want. But it was kind of in his sense of humor, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but so, I must admit that I have a special connection with my father.
Right.
And he always, he passed away in 1999, and the next year I divorced my husband and I left Greece and I came to Cyprus.
Right.
And he had my back. I actually felt his energy behind me. He had my back for the next 4 years until he saw or he felt I didn't need him.
Right.
And it was, I mean, that some people can think I'm very Californian when I say that.
Yeah.
Not people understand that thing that you actually feel someone. And it's not scary. It's actually reassuring.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It's actually reassuring.
It's very reassuring. Yeah.
And also, I also felt him recently, and that's the second tattoo I had.
Oh, look at you.
I had a second tattoo. He was a man that woke up every morning and said thank you to the universe for his wonderful family and the roof over his head. And he always brought us up in gratitude. And this is the symbol of gratitude.
That's beautiful.
So I think the fact that I've had it recently, I felt him again. He had my back. So people, their physical body leaves, but sometimes their spirit stays. Yeah. Sometimes not a lot of comfort because you want a real hug or you want to have a real conversation, but it is reassuring.
You tapped your left shoulder. Do you feel him over your left shoulder?
Yes, over my left shoulder always.
Mine is over the right shoulder.
He's always behind the left side of my body.
My husband is always here to the right. But he does definitely, sometimes things come up and I'm like, oh, how am I going to cope with this? And my husband was I'm sure he was ADHD, but he was incredibly bright. And a big problem solver and loved to juggle five balls at once. Basically, if he didn't have a problem to solve, he was collapsed on
the
sofa.
He was in distress.
Yes. So when a problem comes up, it's literally like a voice might step up to the plate. And I think, okay, I will. I can do this. I got this. William wouldn't do this. He would not let anything make him crumble. He's been a very big influence in helping me continue, because when he died, I had two sons. One was 12, the other 17, and the 17-year-old was incredibly bright, and he had already graduating school and starting college a month later. when I suddenly went from a family of four to just the two of us. And, you know, it's been all right. My boys are great. I adore my boys. And we've just slowly just kept moving forward, you know.
And your home is Los Angeles. That's where you have the four walls and the key to a door, to put it in that way.
Yes, I have a lovely home in Cyprus, and I have a lovely home in Los Angeles. So my mother still has a home in Cyprus, and I come every year for a couple of months. And we've lived there since I was 10 years old. So it's the same house, the same smells and everything. So I really feel that that is my home. But I've kind of recreated it here in Los Angeles. People always come in and they say, oh, this is like your house in Cyprus. It isn't. It's very different. But, you know, we have shelves full of books and cats wandering around and lots of plants. And we've always liked, my whole family have always been very hands-on. My father was a carpenter and a mechanic. My mother made everything. We sew, we knit. I mean, even my son's girlfriend crochets now, which is what Gen XYZ. I don't even know what Gen we're on.
I've wrote, but I think it's Gen,
yeah.
Gen Z. Anyway, I've forgotten.
Yes, yeah.
They've lost me.
Yes, yes.
Well, they're actually starting a really nice project here in Cyprus called Sustainable Fashion, and they had workshops on the weekend with weaving.
Brilliant.
With upscaling furniture, material, with dyeing with natural dyes.
Fantastic.
And, I mean, I went because I've never been particularly creative with my hands. And I've suddenly decided I need to be. I've left-handed, bit of a tremor, so I left it. But now I've decided I've got to find that side of me, and I find it quite relaxing to crochet or to... So they are trying to reintroduce the kids to the... tradition, to the techniques or the arts of tradition.
I'm very much about sustainability, and I came from a family where my grandfather made shirts, and so everyone in the family was either a seamstress or created something. Like I say, my father, when he retired, he was doing woodwork and making. We've all got wooden bowls and egg cups and everything. My brother's also very creative. So we've always made things. And I actually believe there's enough clothes in the world that we don't need new clothes. And my kids all love what they call here thrifting. So they're absolutely right. Because actually, if you go to a cheap shop, you're going to buy cheap shit.
Yes,
but if
I
you
agree.
Go if you go to a thrift store, you can find, you know, $1,000 cashmere coat that somebody's worn once and didn't want it, and pick it up for a fiver. So you're going to get much more interesting things and probably better quality things in a thrift store than you would in a cheap shop. Of course, if you're rich and you can go shopping. But I tell you, I went out Christmas shopping the other day and I came back and I said, that's it. I'm making everyone cookies for Christmas, because everything I picked up had three figures on it, and four figures on it.
Mm. Well, what I do is when I dye clothes, when I wear...
Yes, beautiful.
I've got a dress and I start getting bored. I just find a color to dye it and I'll change color. And voila, I've got a new dress and new life to my wardrobe.
Yeah.
Because I also think if it works, why break it?
I know.
Why break it?
I used to do that. If I liked something, I would recreate it. I mean, I make most of my clothes now. Actually, since William died, I've gone back to dressmaking. I think I was too busy with young kids and everything. But now I make most of my clothes. And when I find a pattern that fits, I just make five the same.
I will connect you. I will send you the link of this traditional fashion heritage to see you'll enjoy their work.
Oh,
but
good,
let's
yeah.
move on to
yeah.
memories as well, because one of the things you've done is a documentary of your journal during the invasion
right.
of 74.
Yes.
So tell me about that, because I told you a friend of mine found her diary from when she was 9 years old.
Fantastic.
Her brother broke into their house in Varosha, and that left it behind. And she's turned it, her daughter turned it into a narration with a documentary, and she turned part of the drawings in the journal into embroideries
That's
because she's a fashion
fantastic.
designer.
I
So
love
please tell
it.
me, it's a lovely idea, and everyone, I think we all were so touched by the documentary and the presentation of her daughter. It really brings things to life without victimizing anyone. And I find a lot of
Right.
the time with the Cyprus problem, people go into victim mode, but this one was actually quite joyful. But tell
Good.
me about your diary.
Well, I mean, essentially, that was probably the first thing that I wrote, because I used to keep diaries when I was little, but it was just like where I was supposed to go and what exam I was doing at school and things like that. And then I woke up on that day, July the 15th, at 8 o'clock or something in the morning, to the sound of gunfire outside my room. It felt like just outside my bedroom, because we live very close to the palace.
Okay.
I mean, a 5-10 minute walk. And so there were actually bullets flying past in our garden, ricocheting off the walls and things. And I
Who were you
grabbed,
at home with? Who were you at home with?
I was at home with my mother and my brother, and we all woke up. My mother ushered us into the kitchen, away from the windows, and I grabbed an old school book and I just started writing down what was happening. And of course, we're starting to make phone calls like, "Where's Dad? Where's everyone?" My father was already downtown at my grandfather's shop in Leader Street, and he walked home with the soldiers and the tanks. And he asked them, you know, what's going on? And they said it was a coup. So he came home and he went straight into sort of, fix mode. We fill the bathtub with water. We, do this. We sit here. We turned on the radio. We started listening to news. And so, as this was all going on around us, I kept a journal for about a month until we were finally evacuated, my brother, my cousin, and
And you
myself.
must have been a young child, a young girl,
I
early teens.
was I was 13,
Okay.
and so I kept it actually up until I went to England. So it's like a sort of a month until and that well, then I ended the story. And I kept the diary for 40 years, and I thought, well, it's a 40-year anniversary. This was back in 2014. And I wondered what to do, and I thought, well, I will enlarge it and print it. And so I printed it on fabric that was from my grandfather's shop. I had an old friend who was a classmate at the time do the printing. I had another old friend from the time do the framing. And I set up the exhibition in a small gallery right on the,
The Green Line.
Everyone gets on at me about what word to use. Is it a border? Is it a buffer zone?
That's
Is
not
it
a
the green?
border.
Yes.
And
No. Yeah, exactly. So,
as long as you don't use the word border, I'm fine.
yes. Okay. So I was going to say the buffer zone, because actually when we opened the exhibition, it was in the street. You had the Greek checkpoint, and beyond that, you could see the mosque. And every night, as I opened the exhibition, the muezzin would call out for the evening prayers. So it again was very much like an installation, because I started it so that it actually ran during the same dates that were in the diary. So you could actually come in and see what happened on this day. And
Wow.
people did. It was incredible. I thought people might just come and have a look at it. I also made the shop look like it was an abandoned shop, like it was our shirt shop that had been abandoned. And so I gathered some bits and pieces from the shop, and I had the diary there as a display. And people would come and literally read every page And then so they'd turn around and say, here, look at this. This is when our dad said, go and empty our you know, cellar or our shop, because they were going to take it. And we didn't listen to him, and it's gone. And another woman was like, oh, my God, this sewing machine. I had this sewing machine. My sister left it on the table in our house in Kyrenia. So it was very emotional for a lot of people. And I really appreciate what you told me about this girl who's done this with the diary, because once I'd done the diary and I did the exhibition, my other friend said, why don't you make a little film of it? So I made the documentary. And I said to my poor editor friend, listen, I can give you like $100 if you can put these little clips together. And she, luckily, Edith really got into it started, you know, building. So we built it. It sort of developed organically. And then from there, I put it on my website. So now it's multifaceted. And that's what I like. You know, I have a website where I have all of my little projects on there. So my writing, my filmmaking, my documentaries, artwork, everything that I do is connected. For example, with The Seamstress of Orpha, the second film I made, when I submitted that to be published, I didn't want to sit around doing nothing. So I decided to do a sort of dramatization of one of the chapters, which I would narrate. Well, that turned into a, you know, half an hour film, and my family were coming to visit. So I said, you're all going to play characters in this film.
Yeah.
And again, I had the same film editor, and she's like, Victoria, can't you write a sort of a shot list so I know exactly what shots to put? I said, no, I'm just doing it organically. I couldn't find a cameraman who would do it for cheap, so I just grabbed the camera myself. Plus, I'm working with 80-year-old women and my friend Mary Woronoff, who's this amazing, fantastic actress. And she was very mercurial. So I was like, listen, it's got to be kind of like guerrilla style. I've got to be like able to take my camera, say, put on this outfit and film for 20 minutes, because I'm never going to get more than that. So I love that film because it's actually very beautiful. And I shocked myself because I'd never filmed anything before. And I was just like, out of frustration, learned how to use the camera. In fact, I spent the whole weekend learning how to use the camera with Google, and then I realized there's just a little button on the side. It was the Canon 5D, and you just go, and now it's movie, and it came up on the screen. I was like, oh, how beautiful.
Wow, magic.
Yes. So then I was like, you know, figured out just a little bit of doing focusing and everything, and then just said it didn't matter about the lines because I was going to do the narration. So I would just be talking and saying, you know, close your eyes, look out the window, pretend to go to sleep, and trying to, you know, herd a bunch of cats, it was actually, because none of them were actors. But my cousin, Billy, came up brilliant. Obviously, he has acting in his, you know, in his bones. No, and his mother. Oh. My cousin and my aunt were absolutely incredible, having never acted before. So yes, all of the work is connected and interconnected, and actually it's funny
because it's all available on your website that I would upload.
Yes.
For the listeners to look at afterwards.
Yes. And in fact, the whole thing about the website is I think on my landing page, I say everything is a story.
Because everything is.
It is. But it's funny because that's also a, what do you call it? What do you call this? An epithet? When things, it's like a little thing that people say, like, oh, everything's a story.
It's a cliche. But I mean, I'm a storyteller. I love listening to stories, and I love being in an environment where I can encourage stories, hence the podcast. And I was, I've spoken to a few people that said to me, oh, I've got no stories. I said, bullshit.
Yeah.
Everyone has at least two stories in them.
Oh, yeah.
It's a case of, and two is, I'm being very stingy. It's usually more than two. But if you actually think about things that you've done, and a story doesn't mean I've done something great.
Yeah.
A story means it can be a small act of kindness. It can be a small act of kindness to yourself. People don't understand that storytelling, even the simple stories, are exceptionally liberating and
Yeah.
healing.
Yes. I mean, sometimes people say to me, where would you, I exactly the same thing. I don't know how to tell stories. And I say, open up your jewelry box or open up your closet and start pulling things out and tell the story of where they came from and how you got them and where who gave them to you and what they
how you means felt.
To. Exactly. And suddenly you've got a treasure trove of stories there.
We actually did that as a group of friends decided to come together one afternoon, one early evening, and we each had to bring one other piece of jewelry, a book, a piece of clothing that had a story. And
Brilliant.
It's amazing how, I mean, I inherited my mother's bracelet that was given to her by my father when they got engaged.
Oh.
And whenever I have that, whenever I wear it, and I don't really wear it because it's quite fragile and I'm scared I'm going to lose it. But when I wear it, I feel as if they both with me.
Yeah.
So I think everyone, no one thinks of, as you said, it can be something small. It can be something, you can see a plate of rice pudding and think, oh, my grandmother used to make it so beautifully and it used to make me feel warm.
Exactly.
It can
exactly.
be very, people think of storytellers and they think of Charles Dickens and William Shakespeare, and it's not. It's the little stories that actually count at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think so.
Tell me, Victoria, how big a part has been Armenian of your life been?
I absolutely identify, sorry, hold on one second, there's a noise going on here, let me just deal with that. Sorry, just get rid of that. Being Armenian, I absolutely grew up thinking that Armageddon was around the corner because that was what my grandmother told me. She learned to read by reading the Bible and then translating everything that she saw on the news in Turkish and saying, you see, this is it.
I told you so.
Exactly.
I told you so.
And I think that our Armenian identity was very, very strong growing up, even though it wasn't pushed down our throats. And I've thought about this, actually, because often people say, you know, it wasn't until I was X, Y, Z years old until I heard my grandmother's stories and I found out what happened to the Armenians. But for me, it was kind of from birth that we heard these stories, that we heard what was going on in our families and how traumatized my grandmother was.
Did you speak Armenian at home?
Well, no, we spoke English at home because both my mother and aunt, we spoke Armeno-Gringlish.
Okay.
If you don't understand it, then birazi.
Okay, I understand. I get the gist. So it was a mash of all the languages.
It was, but my grandmother and great-grandmother and grandfather didn't speak English, so we spoke Armenian with them and English with my mother and my aunt and amongst ourselves. We had this, yes, the mishmash of all of them together. But definitely I'm Armenian in the way I cook, in that I cannot cook for less than 10 people. and I'm always like, in fact, my son came home from college the other day and he saw, you know, there were chops and salad and potatoes and mushrooms with garlic and everything. And he said, who are you cooking for? Who did you have round? I said, me. He said, What? Why all the food? I said, I was hungry, dude. What? And it was like, yeah.
It's as simple as that.
But then I forgot. He's a student, so for him, it's like cereal and toast.
Do your kids speak Armenian? Or do they understand Armenian?
Yeah, they have a few words. My older son, Aram, was born deaf, So he didn't actually become verbal until he was about 2 years old when he got a cochlear implant. And now he speaks a little bit of Chinese. He can read and write Greek and a little bit of Armenian, but they're not really linguists, and Spanish. So they have little bits of languages. And also my younger son, they do Chinese at school here as a second language, which I think is probably a good thing.
Considering they're an up-and-coming power, yeah, and they're going to knock the Americans and the Russians out that window.
Well, yes. And, you know, they can get by in Cyprus. I think they understand the first stage of language, which is, you know, absolutely sort of understanding something and mumbling along with a few words.
But their home is Los Angeles.
Their home is Los Angeles, although my older son, Aram, is working for the U.S. government at the moment on a Jacksonville Naval Air Base down in Florida. And anyway, he's coming home for Christmas, but he's looking for a PhD program, so we'll see where he ends up. He likes cold weather, so he said, I'm applying for Finland. I was like, okay, because that's a place I've never been to. I'll go and visit wherever
he
goes.
Tell him about Iceland too. Iceland's also a good place to go to.
Yeah. Well, he loves Iceland. He loves Iceland. He would love to go and live in Iceland.
That's on my bucket list. I always see these magnificent landscapes and the volcanoes and it's on my bucket list. Although I think you need to be younger because there's a lot of hiking involved, a lot of walking around, and I don't know if I'm up to it, but it still means doesn't mean I won't go if I get the opportunity.
Let's go before it's too late.
Yes, yes. but so many places to visit.
I know. I just saw that they're opening up an airport that can take international flights to Greenland, and that is really icy, so that's a different experience altogether.
Tell me, what other plans have you got? Because I know you do voiceovers, you do acting, you do your writing.
I don't really act anymore, although all my friends
Isn't
think
that how you met your husband?
It is. I was acting at a theatre company called the Soho Theatre Company. And I'd done a play that had a lot of publicity because I had to build up my body like a female bodybuilder and then prance around in my bikini for most of the show. So we actually were up for awards and things, and I was invited to the press night of another play, and so was my husband because he had produced a play shortly before me. And so the publicist introduced us, and my husband says that he fell in love with me at first sight.
When did you fall in love?
On April the 1st, actually, of that same year. Yes, it was April Fool's Day, and I had met him several times, and we'd been out for dinners. Once we met, we discovered that we had a lot of mutual friends in the theatre world. And so he came to see my play, and we went to see the opening night of other plays. And actually, I knew he was a producer, and I didn't want to bother him, although he seemed kind of interested in me. I just thought he was a fascinating, lovely person from the first minute. But I had tickets to go to the opening night of a play at the Royal Court. A friend of mine was in, Ruth Lass. I think it was called Live Like Pigs. And I remember Jude Law was in it. He was like 1920 or something at the time. Mm. And I had tickets for the show. And I, you know, William had said he wanted to come. And I kept ringing his office to say, look, I've got the tickets and let's arrange to meet. And I'd ring, he'd never answer back. He wasn't there and he'd never call me back. And I think, you know, I'd let a week go or something. And then I finally thought, well, look, this is the third time I'm going to call him and I'm actually not going to bother him.
Not comfortable.
Yeah, I'm not going to bother him after this because otherwise it looks like I'm just, you know. And I rang and he picked up and he said, it's you. And I said, yeah, yeah. I said, but you never call me back. And he goes, I didn't have your number. I said, I gave you the number. I lost it. And he said, every time you ring here, they forget to take your message. They don't take your number. And I come back in from lunch or something and they say, oh, this girl, Victoria Harwood, rang. And he goes, what's the number? And they're like, oh, she didn't leave the number because I thought he had it. So we nearly missed the next glorious 25 years because I nearly didn't call him. Luckily, he picked up that day.
And it wasn't the digital period where
you can't see numbers. No, yes.
You can't see numbers.
We needed pens and pieces of paper.
We're coming to the end of this conversation, and okay. I want you to promise that when you come to Cyprus next, we're actually going to meet.
Yes.
So I would like you to share a favorite memory with me. I know you must have millions, but what memory is something that you remember with love, with intensity?
Well,
I know I sprung it on you.
Yeah, you did. I mean, we talked about earlier, you know, my husband passing away. And I think that last year was full of memories because it was like going back to the beginning of our relationship. We turned off everything. We hung out at home. We did Netflix and chill. It's funny because you say a favorite memory and like I said earlier, there was that juxtaposition of that memory of him at the very end. It was one of the most horribly painful things, but also one of the most beautiful. And since then, sometimes when memories come up, like you said, I put down a vase the other day and I thought, I remember that vase that came with these flowers and it was on my birthday and he gave it to me. And it's kind of like a stab of sadness. You know, you suddenly have that little shock of sadness. But I've learnt that there's a key. And sometimes when that sadness comes, if you just manage to find that key and you flick the switch, it can turn into pure joy. Mm. And you say, yes, that was my birthday and he did this and we did that. And it can actually make me feel just as loved and just as happy again. So I find it hard to pick any one particular memory, but just to say that sometimes those heartbreaking memories, if you can learn to find that switch. I don't know how to show you how to find it. It just comes. You just have to try and be conscious of it, and you can turn that into many, many, many beautiful memories of what the reality was.
It's something I need to teach a friend of mine because we were speaking the other day about this thing of coming together and sharing good memories, and she's just me. I don't have any good memories. All I remember are deaths. And there was a lot of sadness in me because I grew up in a family where we were celebrated. My father would speak to everybody's kids, and as the Greeks would say, his mouth would be dripping with honey. If one of us did well, we would be celebrated. Yes. Weddings or anniversaries or just the pure joy of being with her. So to me, it was very difficult at the time to actually tell her this thing that if you actually look deeper,
yes,
there are good memories in the little things. You don't necessarily need to go to the big things.
Exactly.
But you need to be able to flip that switch and say, you know what, someone died, but
yes,
I had good time. What preceded? When I think of them, weren't they kindness? I mean, you're right. You've got to find that switch to not tip the scale on the negative, but find the balance between the heartbreak and the joy, that because no one doesn't give you any joy.
I mean, I always go to Khalil Gibran for that with Your Joy Is Your Sorrow Untold, where I think I was very, very young. And basically it talks about everything that brings you great joy is also the same thing that brings you great sorrow, or rather the other way around. Everything that brings you great sorrow is also the same thing that brought you great joy. And yeah, it's a hard one. I don't think you can learn it. It comes to you. I hope it comes to your friend.
I agree with you. It's not something that is taught. You can't teach someone. It's something that does need to come to you. I mean, I sometimes listen to her and there's a lot of sadness in me because of the way she feels. Because if I'd never found joy in anything.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know how I'd live. Anyway, I think that's a good point to finish on that. Say that quote again.
Well, your joy is your sorrow untold. I'm not sure if I told it rightly, but yes, your joy is your sorrow untold is not that. I used to be able to quote it, but if you look at Khalil Gibran, the prophet, and I think it's on sorrow or joy, but it's beautiful. It literally talks about how everything that brings us joy can also bring us sorrow, and those things that are bringing us sorrow actually were the things that we really loved. So grief and love are inextricably mixed. And I think that's what goes through my books as well, that there are all these moments of grief, but there are also great moments of joy.
Well, I think unless you have a combination of them both, there has to be that dimension.
Well, you're probably on happy Xanax or something.
I'm my own Xanax. I don't need that. But you need to have that balance of happy and sad.
To enjoy
the happy, you need the sadness.
Yeah.
And to enjoy to be able to deal with the sadness, you need the joy.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that everything's intertwined.
It is.
What they say is tears.
Tears
are. It's got something to do with grief. That the tears coming down is. Anyway, I'll think about it later. But everything, if you look at things, even when you're sad, my sister also recently lost her husband. And
I'm sorry.
I'm trying. What can I say?
Yeah.
You have to get used to it, but you also have to get. You have to get used to it in the sense that people will leave.
Yeah.
But if you don't remember the good times and you honor the person, then you're not going to survive. Life's going to be terribly boring and terribly heavy. Anyway, I think it's time.
Wait, there it is. It says, your joy is your sorrow unmasked. And the self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. And then he goes on. So I know we're trying to wrap up, but I won't.
Yes,
so
that's a good one because I think it is the combination. I think if you need to find a way to combine the joy and the grief and the laughter and the tears and the ups and the downs, or else I wouldn't cope otherwise.
Yeah.
I think when I'm feeling unbalanced, I need to start breathing again and remind myself goodness, but good, bad, happy, sad, but I'm okay.
Yeah.
And my dad's got my back.
He's got your wait, sorry, that was your left shoulder. Mine's my right shoulder.
And that's strange that I do that because I'm a lefty. So this would have been, but he's always it's always behind my left shoulder.
Right. Well,
anyway.
Bless him.
Well, bless your late husband as well, but bless all the people that came through our lives and have left.
Yes.
Because they've left good memories. I always believe that.
They've enriched our lives.
Mm. And I'm glad I find memories, home, love, are subjects that you can actually talk about forever.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm holding you to reaching out to me when you come to Cyprus so that we can have a longer conversation.
I think I might come probably May next year because I can't do the hot summer anymore. I've been saying that for decades, but it's July and August. It's getting worse, yeah.
It's getting worse. Yeah. Okay, so look forward to seeing you
in May. Yes, absolutely.
I really enjoyed this conversation, and may we all have a good 25.
Fantastic. Yes. Fingers crossed
And
for that.
yeah,
To whom
and
it
to our
might
listeners,
concern.
exactly. And to our listeners, thank you for listening, and I'll upload the website, Victoria's website, so you can check out her work, because she's an interesting woman, a multifaceted interesting woman.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, and have a lovely rest of the day, Victoria.
All right then, take care. Bye
You
bye.
too. Bye-bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open, diverse, free.